So for this evening's talk, after the meditation, it's nice having the opportunity to give a Dhamma talk. And of course you have many, many possible things to talk about. But one of the things I wanted to talk about today, I'm going to combine two things. And one is on the idea, or I won't call it idea, call it the truth, the reality of rebirth. And how do we know? How can you be sure that such a thing like rebirth, reincarnation, is a truth? This is one of the things which often challenged me when I was young. You know, how do we know that this thing, or anything in life, is a true idea, or it is false? And even for many of you who are philosophers, or who have some interest in philosophy, always remember, it was, I think, Socrates who said, everybody thinks they are right. And that's not just a superficial statement. Even each one of you, whatever you say to your friend, to your partner, you always think that what you're saying is true. And you can't think that what you're saying is wrong. It's only later on you realize, yes, I was wrong. But right now, truth is this almost like disease which we all have, which explains a lot why we all argue. So how can we find out who's telling the truth and who's not telling the truth? What is true? What is right? And we get something like, you know, what is very common to Buddhism. It's very certain the Buddha taught about rebirth, reincarnation, whatever you wish to call it. But how can you be sure that that is actually true? And that has a lot of consequences to people. So it's important to find out what's true. And the way to find out what's true is we can use logic, first of all, but that's not deep enough. I know that sometimes people keep arguing with me. They say, how can you believe in rebirth when there's more people alive today than probably have ever died? Where did they all come from? And the first thing to say is there's a kind of like arrogance amongst human beings. We always think we're so much superior than to things like even animals. The animals are like our servants or our slaves. We just make use of them, exploit them. But I don't know how many of you have had pets and you got very close to those pets. And they do have emotions. They do have intelligence. And they do things which can sometimes shock you. And I do still recall the first time, it must be about 20 years ago now, somebody showed me a video of Alex the parrot, A-L-E-X, and parrot. He's an African grey parrot who was a subject of an experiment, a kind experiment. Some psychologist who had knowledge of a way of teaching those with intellectual disabilities, learning disabilities, how to talk. You know, sometimes kids, it's not that they're naughty, but just they have some blockages about learning how to speak the local language. And of course, some of these psychologists have worked out very good techniques in order to teach kids how to speak. Not maybe the normal lessons which other kids have in school, but specialized for them. So these couple of psychologists over in the United States, they tried to teach a parrot how to talk. And I don't mean like pieces of eight or a naughty language. I mean how to have enough of a vocabulary to be able to use these words intelligently. And the first time I saw Alex the parrot having a conversation with people, it kind of really sort of gave me the goosebumps. there was a parrot having a conversation. This wasn't AI. This wasn't just Hollywood dubbing anything. This was a real parrot. He could talk with other parrots and with human beings. And what really convinced me was when he was talking with what we call these days with attitude. "I'm fed up, can I go now?" said the parrot. This was not Hollywood, this was not sort of visual effects, this was real, actually happening, a parrot speaking. And there's been so many other cases. There was this gorilla over in New York Zoo, I think it was called Coco, K-O-K-O. And they taught this big gorilla sign language. And what really convinced them that he was using this intelligently, understanding what he was doing, was when they saw him doing this thing alone. He's basically talking to himself by using sign language with the digits of his hand. There's so many cases of that, of animals acting very intelligently, to the point that you cannot deny their intelligence. We sometimes think that we are so much superior, than some of the animals. Are we? So sometimes, this is not just modern forms of Buddhism, this is from the very early start. Human beings, they can be reborn from animals. Okay, just to keep it interesting, because sometimes I feel that people, maybe just I'm losing them, being a bit too serious. In one of the monasteries over in the northeast of Thailand, there was a monk there. He's been over here to Perth. I really respect him. When he comes to visit, all he carries is, just like me, just one bag. He's very simple, a great meditator. But remember that in his monastery, like many monasteries, you try and be kind to the animals as best you can. So somebody saw this, it was a monkey, and he was actually just in a cage in the market. And in order to give this monkey a life, one of the lay supporters bought that monkey and asked to release it in the monastery. At least the monastery, forest monastery, had trees, and the monks could let it swing around wherever it wanted to go. And so this monk joined this monastery and became a kind of pet. Whenever the monks would have tea in the afternoon, the monkey would also sit in the group and have a cup of tea. It was really quite cute. It was a wild monkey, it wasn't really a pet. It wasn't sort of hurt at all, but always was well fed. And this monkey would always be obviously just very, very grateful to the head monk. So much so that sometimes you had visitors who would come in from Bangkok to see the head monk. And sometimes, please excuse me, it's like Thai custom, sometimes you're cheeky. And so this monk, one of these ladies from Bangkok was a bit cheeky to the head monk. And this monkey would actually jump on people's laps and let them stroke it. And of course, people loved actually stroking this very docile monkey. And then he would jump into the next person's lap. And when he got to the lady who was being cheeky, he'd jump into her lap. She'd go to stroke him, and he would bite her. Say, so, don't mess around with, the head monk of this monastery. But, he's so well loved by everybody. But like many animals, like dogs chasing cars, if there was any sort of noisy truck or car past the monastery gate, the monkey would always chase it. And one day that poor monkey got hit by the truck and got killed. And the head monk should not have said this. The head monk saw what happened next. This monkey So is what we call in Buddhism the stream of consciousness of that monkey leave his body, hit by the truck, and float off into the village. These villages support the monasteries. So we all know, you know, who's who in that village. And this monkey went into a pregnant woman's body. That's what he saw. He told the monks he saw the stream of consciousness go in to a pregnant woman. When that word got around, they all could not wait until that woman gave birth. They would see her on arms around. They want to find out what happens if in your previous life you were a monkey. This is not a joke. You know, sometimes I am serious. This is true. I never saw that kid because I'd left by that time. But when the lady gave birth, I couldn't help but ask those monks who saw it, what did the kid look like? What did the baby look like? And they said the baby was exceptionally hairy. It was a monkey before. I don't doubt that monk at all, that senior monk. You know, I've got a lot of respect for him. A good meditator. This is actually kind of what happens. So having the idea that it's only from human to human and nothing else is totally wrong, which means that there's a huge resource of people where we came from before. That's the answer to the question when people say, there's so many human beings alive now, where did they come from? There's so few animals left, many of their habitats have been destroyed. They don't have as many places where they can live and thrive. Many of those have been reborn as humans. The difference is not that great. So anyhow, straight away, you understand that this is where many people come from, where many people may go to. Okay, a little funny story now. One of the fellows many years ago, I don't know who he is, I hope he has changed his mind, he once told me that he believed in reincarnation or rebirth, and he said in his next life he thought about it, and he said he wanted to be a dog in his next life. Why would anybody want to be reborn as a dog? In many Asian countries, calling a person a dog is almost a term of abuse. I don't mean it, this is Asia, and I kind of like dogs, and he liked dogs as well. And he said, look, think about it, use reason and logic. I don't know where you've been today. Many of you have been working. You had to get up very early in the morning and work really hard. You're never paid enough. You may be having a boss always tells you what to do and tells you off. If you're reborn as a dog, you don't have to go to work. Instead, you just lie in a beautiful house all day with nothing to do. You go around playing, you get incredibly good food these days, and you get free health care, and you got nothing. All you have to do, the only work you have to do, is to take your owner out for a walk once a day or twice a day. That's all. Pretty good life. You don't have any worries at all. You don't have to worry about money, taxes. Do any dogs pay tax? So he said, I thought about it, done my research. I want to be reborn as a dog in my next life. And that's when I told him. Here in Australia, once you're born as a dog, you have to go to the vet to get de-sexed. And you can say, you can see on his face when I told him that. And he knew that, but he forgot to take it into consideration. He thought, okay, you win now, Jambaram. I don't want to be a dog in my next life. Dogs aren't that different than human beings. This was one of my favorite stories, which somebody told me, that there was a lady, this was in some city over in the United States. She came back from the supermarket, you know, with the shopping, and she was, you know, two big bags in her hands, really hard even to get the keys out to open the door of the house. So she managed to open up the door of the house, kick it open, and then this big dog ran past her into her house. She couldn't stop it because her hands were full with her shopping bags and the keys. And so, you know, she went into the kitchen, put the bags down, and looked for the dog who'd come into her house. She didn't know it. And when she found the dog, it was a very clean dog, a big dog, a Labrador or something. It was curled up in a corner, sleeping. It was no problem at all. It was obviously not a wild dog. Someone owned it, had a collar on it. It was just sleeping in the corner of her own house in one of her rooms. And she thought, it's not causing any trouble. And it kind of liked the dog. So she left it there. And she put away her shopping. And then about an hour later, she heard the dog move and do a little bark. So she went to check up on it. And the dog went to the front door, so she let it out. She didn't know why this dog came to visit her, but the next day the dog came back again. So she let it in, went to sleep in one of the rooms there, nice and quietly. And the dog came in the third day too. And so she started to wonder, I mean, what is this dog? Why is this? Obviously, it's got an owner somewhere. Why is it coming into her house every afternoon? And just all it needs is just an hour curled up in a nice corner to sleep. So she told her husband, and her husband had this really good idea. She said, look, I've never seen this dog before, but you know, if it's not causing you any trouble, he said, no, it's nice having a little dog there for an hour. So he said, what we can do, we'll get a piece of paper and write a note on this paper. Your dog has been coming to sleep in my house for 1 hour every afternoon. I don't know who you are or why it comes here, but can you please let us know? And they folded the note up and put it under the dog's collar. So the next time the dog, you know, came, and then the dog left to go wherever it went to, and it took the note with it. And of course, the next time the dog came, they saw the dog, and it went to sleep in one of the nice places there, and very gently they took a new note out from under its collar, the reply. And the reply was something like, this is my dog, so she lives a couple of blocks away from you. In my house, we have 3 or 4 kids, a wife, husband, uncle, and father or something. It's always so noisy in our house. Obviously, our dog comes to your place to get some peace and quiet for 1 hour away from everybody else. Can I please come too? Even dogs get stressed out. And that's even why I love going on tangents. Do you remember George, the cat? A cat turned up at Bodhinyana Monastery about 4 or 5 years ago, at the very start of our retreat period, the rains retreat, the beginning of July. In a day or two, from that retreat. And we didn't know who that cat belonged to. There was no signs up locally saying we've lost a cat. It was a very beautiful cat, really friendly. So, you know, you could sit down, it'll come and very gently just climb on your lap, you can stroke it. It wouldn't cause you any trouble whatsoever. And of course, for emotionally restrained monks, it was nice having a little cat to have a stroke. But of course we can't keep cats because, you know, they had animals. But we just let it stay there for our rains retreat for 3 months. And then we had a meeting and we said, what should we do with this cat? And we all decided, you know, by discussing together, It's just too nice. It doesn't seem to be aggressive. It doesn't seem to be, you know, going out in the evening and just catching things. So he said, let's see if we can keep it for a while. So we had to then take it to the vet because, you know, all animals have to be chipped. And we found out when we took it to the vet, it had already been chipped. It did have a name, George. And it lived over in South Perth. That's where its owner was registered. We couldn't believe, what, come all the way from South Perth to Serpentine? So we rang up the owner, and he said, oh, that's where George went. It's been missing for about 3 months. He said, yeah, it's with us over in the Buddhist monastery. Are you Buddhist? He said, no, we don't know anything about Buddhism. But we all decided afterwards, we had to take the cat back, or the owners came to pick it up. We all decided that that cat must have been a Buddhist and decided to have at least 3 months on retreat at Bodhinyana Monastery. And it succeeded in the same. Why on earth would a cat just suddenly appear in the monastery all that way? But anyway, too many animals, when you actually see them, they're not that different from human beings. So that's where where many people come from. And there's many other realms of existence as well. Heavenly beings. Do any of you believe in heavenly beings? This is one of those stories, and I love telling this. I'm just thinking if Ananda is here, because he loves this story. These are all true stories. I know these stories. I know the people who were part of this story. Just not long ago, it was maybe about 30, 40 years ago, the American Peace Corps were very active in Thailand. And one of those Peace Corps activists, after finishing his 2 years stint working for the Peace Corps, he decided to see if he could become a monk, to try it out, to see what it was like. He'd seen the monks, but he didn't really understand too much what it meant to be a monk. But nevertheless, he knew that you could ordain as a monk for a short time. So he asked the concierge at the hotel he was staying in, how do you become a monk? And of course, that's not the correct person to ask, a concierge. But the concierge just said, well, I don't know, but there's one monastery that's called Wat Bawon. Sometimes they have Western monks there. So, go there early in the morning, take some food, offer it to one of the monks, and ask, you know, I want to be a monk. Pretty simple. So he went early in the morning, he took some food, and he got there way too early. It's about 4 o'clock in the morning. The gates don't open until maybe 6:30, till dawn. But anyway, he was walking up and down outside Wat Bawon. It's a walled monastery. All the gates were closed. And there was hardly anybody around. And that's when this Thai man came up to him and asked what he was doing. And he said, well, I want to be a monk. I was told to come here early in the morning and give some food to another monk, and then he will help me. And the Thai man said, you've got the wrong time. And the monks won't be out for another couple of hours. But, said this Thai man, I have the keys. I can take you inside. So this Thai man took out this bunch of keys and opened this big metal gates in the front of Wat Bawon and opened the gate and led him along the path to the most holiest of halls in Wat Bawon. It's the hall in which they give ordination to the royal family in Thailand and to any other monk or any other big ceremony there in the boat at Wat Bawon. He took him inside, he opened the doors of the boat, turned the electricity on, And if any of you have seen those Thai temples, there's always lots of paintings on the walls. And those paintings were done over 200 years ago. And, actually 250 years ago probably now. And this Thai man knew everything about these paintings. Told him exactly what they meant and why they meant it. Why they were offered sometimes in memory of somebody who passed away. So, the time went so fast. And after a couple of hours, they got to the last drawing, mural, and then this Thai man said, the monks are going to come out soon. So you go out, I will lock up and turn the electricity on, and wait for this old monk. And when the old monk comes out, ask him, he's the one to ask. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And that's what happened. The old Thai man, or the Thai man, closed up, and the American man in the Peace Corps sort of went outside, waited, and asked the first old monk he saw, said, I want to be a monk, can you help me? The monk said, wait here, and then I'll take you inside afterwards. And that's where he started his training to become a monk. Trouble was that many of those monks assigned to train him could not speak good English. He couldn't understand exactly what they were telling him to do. So after two or three days, he asked, haven't you got somebody else who can speak better English? And they said, no, this monk is the best English speaker we have. And that's when he said, what about that Thai man who let me in the first day and who showed me around the hall? And that's when the monks said, what are you talking about? Number one, no foreigner, like American, is allowed to walk through that gate. Not even I could walk through that gate. It's called the Royal Gate at Wat Pa Wan. This is not being made up. I learned this a long time ago when I used to sometimes stay in that monastery. Only kings and royal family can walk through there. What do you mean you went into the hall? They don't let the key to this really important building stay with the layperson. This is with the head monk in his office. You can't even turn electricity on there. And not even the monks knew all those murals of a couple of hundred years old. You know, who painted them and why they were donated. A lot of times it's because somebody in your family passed away. And this Thai man knew everything. So, they were so surprised they took him straight to the abbot's office, the oldest monk in the monastery. And the abbot listened to him, stopped him, and said, bring the secretary now. He wanted to take down all the details of this. Because again, no one has those keys. No one can open that door. Not even the old monk. He became the head monk of Thailand later, Somdet Nyanasangwon. And not even he knew all of those stories. So once he took it all down, that's when he asked this Westerner, this Peace Corps American, what did the man look like? Now, a lot of times you might say, well, you know, the Thai man will look the same. You might say that, but that's not a good answer. He said, well, I don't know. One strange thing about him, he was not wearing modern clothes, but old style Thai clothes. Well, but what did he look like? And that's when this American scratching his head, as you do when you're trying to think. And he was just looking around, and he froze. It was him. It was him. There was a portrait of this man in the abbot's office. That was who he was. The American had never been in the abbot's office before, never knew who this person was. And that was His Majesty King Rama IV, the founder of that monastery. He was the one who made sure it was built. He was royalty, Thai royalty, which is why he could walk through that gate. He was there when those murals were painted, which is why he knew all about those murals. And this Western never seen a portrait of one of these old Thai kings before. I know that story. I remember telling that story over in all places in the Thai embassy over in, I think it was over in Singapore, when the Thai ambassador stood up, interrupted me, and said, "Ajahn Brahm, so I just want to let you know that that story is 100% correct." He said he was on the board of managers of Wat Pa Won. He's seen that record. This is actually what happened. A heavenly being coming down to help a Westerner become a monk. It wasn't a temporary ordination either. He was a monk for so many years. I lost contact with him when he went to the United States. These are true stories. There are beings in this world, not just animals, but heavenly beings as well, who can sometimes come and help when they're really needed. But anyway, because there's so many different types of beings in this world, that's why rebirth can actually happen. But how do you know it happens? We have all these little evidences, these little anecdotes, but how can you know for sure? How you can know for sure? This is one of the reasons why, as Buddhists, we don't just read books. We sit on our backside or on a chair and learn how to make our mind still, how to meditate. That's why we always keep focusing and emphasizing. I was going to say stressing about meditation. It's the wrong word to stress. But emphasizing it, focusing it. Because what happens when you do meditate? When your mind becomes still, the five senses become suppressed. So seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, even your body tends to become so comfortable that many of the sensations disappear. Like when you go to sleep at night, so your five senses kind of vanish, but not as good as when you meditate. When you meditate, you're perfectly aware. The sixth sense of the mind, and that is a separate sense from everything else. I was a theoretical physicist before. I know that's a truth. Well, I see the people keep denying the existence of a mind. Even you need a mind to actually to create reality. That's in quantum theory. But let's go past that for a moment. That's the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum theory. But anyhow, well, this is technical stuff. Anyhow, you do need a mind. A mind exists. It's an important part of the world. And anyone who keeps denying this is missing so much truth about the world. So anyhow, once the mind becomes strong, we have something in Buddhism we call they call it the five hindrances, which distort your perception. Why do you see things which aren't really there? Why do we exaggerate things? It's because we see what we want to see. We deny what's too challenging for us to see, or to hear, to taste, to touch, to feel. We're so restless, mind thinking all the time. We're not still enough to really penetrate into something. Or we're too tired, our mind is weak, no energy. Or we have this terrible doubt that instead of actually seeing what's there, We say, this can't be true because it doesn't fit with what I've been told. It's one of my sayings, if you ever want to write it down. Never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. Truth is right in front of you. The learning says, that can't be true, that can't be true. I know it's not true. It doesn't exist. But it's right there. So, eventually, your mind becomes so strong, so powerful, and it's not distorted at all. And that's when, for those of you who want to follow this deeper and find out rebirth, reincarnation, it's not what you believe. What do you know? And that's when you ask yourself something like, what is my earliest memory? You're very peaceful and still in your meditation. As you're coming out, what is my earliest memory? And when I've done this, taught this, so many people, if it's going to happen, it happens immediately. There's no pause. You don't force it. That suggestion is enough that you can feel, see, hear, whatever is dominant at that time. This image from the past is not a memory in the same way you memorize, you know, what you had for dinner this evening, if you had a dinner, what you had for lunch. What did you have for lunch today? You can remember that, but that's not the same type of memory I'm talking about. This is when you're right back there, re-experiencing it. I have to be careful because I have rules of discipline. But many of you heard me tell this story before, that one of the loopholes, because you need to actually tell this, to stand behind what you're saying. I cannot tell you about previous lives of mine. It's against the Vinaya rules. It's frustrating, but it's right there. I can't do anything about that. But what I do is the earliest life memory from this life. Over in Bodhinyana Monastery, where many of you have been, sitting down there many years ago, having a nice meditation, when you came out afterwards, I don't know where this idea came from, what's my earliest memory, but as soon as I thought that, as you were coming out of a deep meditation, straight away, I was in my baby's pram. I was a little kid, maybe 2-3 weeks old. Not quite sure exactly how old. But I was in my pram, and I could recognize everything in that pram. You're right back there. But my mind was of a monk, middle-aged by then, but the body was of a baby. And I could actually explore that baby's pram where I was in. My mother, I could recognize her. But with my mother, it wasn't how she looked, which was my means of recognition. It was how she smelled. Her fragrance was how I recognized her. In fact, even some of the pillows and blankets in that pram, it was their smell. That was quite strange to me. I was a physicist before I became a monk, not sort of a doctor doing medicine. But later on, when I asked a few people, they said, yes, babies recognize their surroundings, and especially their family, by how they smell. Not what they look like, not even what they sound like, not what they touch like. It's their smell. It's a dominant sense for young people when they're growing up. Just like, you know, a dog recognizes you by how you smell, and no matter what age they are. But a baby also recognizes your fragrance. You know, it's weird, but when you've experienced that, and those memories never leave you because they're powerful memories, re-experiencing of the past, you notice how true that is. It's not a theory anymore. It's an experience. You know, how on earth that can happen? But it does happen. You find out who you were. Another lady, she came to monastery a few days ago. One says she's getting quite old now. When I taught her this meditation, she recalled, you know, she had good meditation, so when, what's my earliest memory? She was back there as a baby, breastfeeding. But the problem was, she came and told me afterwards. It really shocked her, because the person who was feeding her was not her mother. And so she said, Ajahn Brahm, look, I'm just freaking out at this. And it was a real experience. I saw my mother in front of me, and she was but it wasn't my mother breastfeeding me. So I told her, next time you have an opportunity to talk to your mum, you know, just ask her, Mum, I had this experience. Are you really my mum? Or was I adopted? Because sometimes that happens. And so she asked her mum. It's good that I knew her mum and the mum knew me. They went on one of these pilgrimages with me to India. So her mother was, you know, quite shocked. What are you talking about? Where did that idea come up? I'm not your mother. So she told the anecdote about remembering when she was a little kid being breastfed. And that's when her mother asked her, what did that lady look like? And so this member, she was a committee member many years ago, she told what this woman looked like. And the mother was so shocked. So that's an amazing description you've just given of your wet nurse. We hired a woman to feed you when you were small, when really small, and that was your wet nurse. How on earth can you remember that? So these are some things, if that happens to you, then of course you know that you lived before. You know, that's one of the things, the reason I give talks like this, the reason why I ask you to meditate and meditate deeply on retreats, and where I try and teach that to people who are getting into some powerful meditation. Because what that means is you get your own experience, not theory anymore, not ideas. You understand how this works, and if you want to find out your previous life, you ask yourself, earlier, please. And when I say this, I have to add a little caution. Because sometimes if you trace your this type of memory, memory not in the brain but in the mind back earlier, what you actually often come across is a time when you died last time. And of course you understand that dying is quite unpleasant. Death is pleasant. Once you get past that point of dying and you get to the death point, then it's fine. But just beforehand can be quite scary and painful, traumatic, because it's not just a memory, you're back there experiencing this. So, always remember, if you come across anything which is unpleasant, please ask yourself, earlier please. Don't linger there. In this type of meditation, your mind can go back so easily, so quickly. You go back to before that experience, which you remember as your last experience on this earth, in the life before. Earlier, please. And then you can come across the fact that you know that was you. You never have any more doubts about rebirth. And what that does, you know, once you have this certainty from your own experience about rebirth, then it'd be really weird if you're the only person in the universe who was reborn and no one else was. And it's not just something which kind of sounds nice or fits nice. It's not because you believe, you know, because you've known me for such a long time and I don't tell fibs. It's no, it's actually real. What would that do to you? What that does to you is it takes away a lot of the fear of death. Not the fear of dying, because again, dying can be unpleasant, but the death itself. And it's still to this day, I can't, if you can understand your past lives, if somebody gets very, very sick and they're in great pain and they finally pass away. Okay, I'm going to be personal now about even my own mother. This is my mum who looked after me for so many years, who cared for me, who was courageous enough when I asked her, can I please go off to Thailand to become a monk? She said, yes, you may. I wish you could be a monk next door so I could always visit you, but at least, you know, I want you to be happy. So if you want to be a monk, off you go. So of course there's a great amount of love there. And also that whenever I could, eventually she got dementia. So I remember visiting her in the dementia ward. And you think that I was her son. It didn't get many people in the dementia ward went in with a brown robe. But, you know, I went in with a brown robe. She still didn't remember me. Didn't know who the heck I was. But nevertheless, you'd always go in there. She may not know who I was, but I knew who she was. That was my mum. That was important. But eventually, my brother sent, and I actually called, phoned, and said, you know, our mum's had a fall. She's really sick. And I kind of guessed that she was going to die. But nevertheless, I did as much chanting as I could for your own mother from Serpentine. And then another call came through. Yes, she's passed away. When my mother passed away, I never felt sad. I felt this sense of relief. Honestly, I felt that my mother had been in a jail for about 3 years with dementia. She was healthy enough, you know, physically not in too much pain, but she hadn't got a clue what was going on and where she was. And I remember mentioning to a few people, I feel that my mother's been released from a jail, you know, the jail of her body, and now she's free again. And that's kind of what happens. So that's one of the reasons why sometimes a few people came up to me and said, oh, Ajahn Brahm, anything I can do to help? They had a lot of sympathy for me. Said, look, you don't need that. I understand what death is, so you don't need to feel sad at all. The person I really cared for was now free. And not making that up, but knowing that. And even just, saying too much again, one story, then I'll finish off. And that was, for many of you who've been around a long time, if you remember this man, Peter Sale? He actually did join our committee. I forced him to come on our committee for a year. He was a good man, but he was sleeping just around the corner here in Nala Way, Nala Mara. We go there on alms round every week. I'll be going there tomorrow, walking for alms round. This was many, many years ago. He was a ranger with, it was Stirling Shire. Stirling? One of the shires, anyway. And not this one over here, but a neighbouring shire. A ranger. And I think he's still alive over in Tasmania somewhere now. But he gave me permission to tell this story because it's personal. He was staying at home just round the corner in Nala Way, Nala Mara, and by himself, middle of the night, sort of woke up, something strange was going on, so he turned on the bedside light. His mother was standing at the end of the bed. His mother lives in Essex, in UK, not in Nala Mara. But he said as soon as he saw her, he knew immediately that was his mum. She must have died. It was a ghost. Not at all afraid, but just kind of seeing his mother again for the first time in about a year or something. And all she was doing was standing there smiling at him. If you have a loving mother, had some wonderful times with her, to actually just see her just at the end of your bed, smiling with so much love and care, even though you knew this would be the last time you see her, she must have died, because she was over in UK. About 6 or 7 minutes, he said. Not a flash, but all the time there. And he was enjoying every second of it. And after 5, 6, 7 minutes, that's when she literally faded away. And he got up. I have to tell this part of the story. He got up. What does an Englishman do when a thing like that happens? Make yourself a cup of tea. English people are just so into tea. Even when Ajahn Chah went over to the West, he went to UK. When he came back, we asked him, did you learn any words of English? In Thai, he said, only one, cup of tea. That's the only thing he remembered, cup of tea. But anyway, having a cup of tea, Peter, and then telephone rang, answer the telephone.
Good.
It says, sister, Pete, we've got some bad news for you. Yeah, I know, Mum's dead. What? How do you know? How come you're not upset? And that's when Peter told his sister that his mum had just visited him. It's important. You can't do that in just 1 second all the way from UK to Nala Way in Australia in 1 second or less than that. He just was there, clear, just smiling, giving the love to him one last time. He said, that was a wonderful experience. How could you be afraid? There are other beings in this world. And when a person understands things like rebirth and reincarnation, whatever you wish to call it, as I keep saying, then those opportunities, you're not crazy. Every time, you know, you've been with somebody who's lost a parent, a loved one, you know, in another country and they can't go and be with them in the last moments. Sometimes it does happen. They can come and be with you. That's gorgeous. It's beautiful. So please, if you still have any doubts about rebirth, reincarnation, don't believe me. Get your meditation going. Ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? And see if it can work. It's opening up a huge area of experience which you can investigate yourself and find out some of the most important truths of life. Not relying on what you read or what you hear, but what's right there. Thank you for listening. Okay. Hopefully that was useful for you. I did give it everything I got to make sure. There's other ways of understanding about past lives through hypnotic regression. And I know there's at least one person here who had hypnotic regression and found out who he was in a previous life. But he hasn't given me permission to say anything, so I'll be quiet. See what questions we have here. Here we go. Okay, first question, Jennifer Chan from USA. How many times a human can go through reincarnation before free from rebirth? How does one find out how far one is in? So basically, hundreds, thousands of times. It's so much to actually to learn, to know, and to grow. So you can go many, many times. It's not always going up. Sometimes we regress as well. Now we have this, again, it's a conceit thing. We're always growing, we always learn, we always go better. There's always evolution. But there's devolution as well. So it's really up to you. Just how much you learn how to practice and to make your mind still and see the truth of things. From Australia. When I overcome fear and anxiety in one aspect of my life, I notice it just moves to another area of my life where previously there was no fear and anxiety. Please advise. That reminds me of the story of Dr. K. Sri Dharmananda, who was asked to get rid of a ghost in a nearby house. He was very good at doing the chanting to get rid of ghosts, and sure enough, and this was in the town of Brickfields in Malaysia, the ghost left the house. The next day he was invited in by the neighbors of this guy who had a ghost, because the ghost just moved next door. This is not a joke, this is actually true. He had to chant in all the houses in the street to make sure the ghost never just went next door, but actually just left the whole neighborhood. That's like overcoming fear and anxiety in one aspect of your life, and the fear and anxiety just moves next door. Find out what fear and anxiety really is. Don't just try and get rid of it. Understand it. When you understand it, it's very easy to let it go. Chinese Art of War. It's not a very good book to quote from, but it does say, know your enemy, know yourself, 1,000 battles fought, 1,000 battles won. If you know what fear and anxiety are, then it's easy to just move past it. If you want to know what they are, I think even recently I gave some talks on anxiety. Fear is quite next to it. Understand what they are, and then you have all the power you need over them. From Germany, what do you do when you have questions and there's no one around to ask, and that for a long time? How do you get any answers? You are on your own. You just asked a question. So if the karma is ripe, then it's pretty easy to get an answer. It's really strange that sometimes when you're ready to hear that answer, sometimes the answer is there in front of you. And after a while, the questions, you've got to make sure you're formulating good questions first of all, because sometimes some of the questions are just crazy questions. The question is not right. That's why sometimes you don't get answers. Get decent questions, and then the answers are easy to come by. From Brazil, I was raised Catholic, but I practice Buddhism for 20 plus years now, but I miss the peace a sky daddy gave me. Is it okay to believe in God being a Buddhist? I think I answered that question, I think, last couple of weeks ago. Is it, what does a God mean to a Buddhist? Again, that was the question asked me by Father Frank Brennan in a conference many years ago. And I used that saying, I'll do it quickly because I'm sure you remember this, from Abbot Placid, the former boss at New Norcia Monastery. He said one of his core beliefs was everybody searches for God. I respect that fellow. So I use that to an answer. What do you search for? Of course you're searching for something. Sometimes you're searching for the end of this talk so you can get up and get something to eat or you can go home. But more than that, what are you searching for in life? Are you searching for, this is one of the things I didn't mention last time, searching for to understand what it's like to be loved, to be really loved, to receive that unconditional love from somebody. And what it's like to love somebody else, unconditionally, with no fear, naturally. What it's like to have peace in your life. What is peace? To have it right there. What is it like to have respect in the place you work? Sometimes you're brilliant at work. Sometimes you make big mistakes. Welcome, you're a human being. So to be respected, you do have off days, but you don't do those on purpose. You're trying your best. What does it mean to know what kindness is, what compassion is? So, that's why I started answering like that. If everybody is searching for God, and as Buddhists, atheists, you're searching for peace, for love, for truth, respect, kindness, peace, then that must be what God is. So if you're a Buddhist, you can say that. You are a sky daddy, not a sky daddy who can give you everything you want, because if you get everything you want, things aren't worth anything anymore if they come from a sky daddy. No one will ever give you what you want, but they can give you what you need. Sometimes some disappointments. That's where we learn how to recognize the value of things. And sometimes they don't work. I don't know about you, and a simple thing like water. We've had a drought over in the southwest, especially in summertime. We haven't had any rain in that monastery for over 6 months now. So the trees are dying. They're very, very dry. And even the kangaroos, you know, they're really hungry. There's no real grass there. So you can see them if you visit Serpentine Monastery, they hang around. We feed them some pony cubes. We only do that when it's really, really dry in order to make sure that they at least have something to eat. So that's actually, I'm sure those kangaroos look at us and think we are their sky daddies, these brown robed monks in Serpentine who feed them this thing which keeps them alive. So being a Buddhist, don't just believe in just a sky daddy, believe in kindness. Because sometimes you'll be that sky daddy helping somebody else. Okay, we've got a request for it. Oops. Request from the internet, could you Ajahn share merits of this talk to all beings and perform a blessing dedicated to all beings who have been harmed and been harmed, helped and been helped by? I'll do that at the very end, because we have a chant for that. But first of all, are there any questions from the audience here for tonight's talk? Quick one? Yeah, Eddie?
Oh. Nobody. Ajahn Brahm, thanks for telling us the interesting stories on rebirth, you know, to show that it is true. There's no doubt it's true, you know. I'd just like to share with you and get your opinion, my opinion on how I come to accept rebirth, you know. Okay, yeah. The Buddha, in the scriptures, it was stated, you know, when the Buddha first got enlightenment, the first thing he saw was his previous lives, you know. Previous one lifetime, 2, 10, 20, 1,000s, blah, 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 all these things, okay? That made me feel, oh, well, there's something to it, isn't it? First one, just two, right? Yeah, yeah. Second one, okay? Second one, you know, like say, for example, us, you know, say John, for example, John living in this earth, and there's a universe, you know, all right? Yeah, he doesn't know what's going on, isn't it? The Buddha told us, you know, in the 31 planes of existence, you know, the 31 planes of existence can be compared to the universe. The fifth plane is where the human beings are. You know? And then it says that we transmigrate, you know. We are reborn into different planes. We are trapped in samsara, you know.
Okay.
The only way to get out is through nirvana. So that made me feel that, oh, there is rebirth, you know.
Yeah. We can actually prove it for yourself. And that is the most powerful. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I've seen a few people getting very tired and about to go. I don't want them to be reborn this evening. So I'm going to do that beautiful request somebody had. What we often do, we do a sharing of merits. This is with our relations. I don't usually do this. It's very, very Buddhist, but it does actually work. The merits of you listening to this talk and people like Eddie paying so much attention, they ask these questions, and everybody else. I'm going to do this chant. It means, I dang me nyati nang ho tu, means, this by me, to my relations, sukita hontu yatayo. May that happiness go to my relations. In other words, that your good karma today, your merits, goodness, we're also dedicating some of this to the people without whom we wouldn't be here today. Your relations, your parents, loved ones, the sharing of merits. I will do the chanting. I've just told you the meaning. Please allow it to soak in. Idam me nyati nang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyati nang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyati nang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo.
Sadhu.
Excellent. So I will now do the ending of the talk by bowing three times and doing the